after the party, it's the Waffle House. If you ever been here, you know what I'm talking about. Where people don't dance, all they do is this. And after the original, you know what it is.
Welcome to Atlanta.
Remix, it had to go down. I got something else to tell you about the new Motown. Where people don't visit, they move out here. And ain't no telling who you might see up in Lenox Square. I don't know about you, but I miss the
good day, everyone. Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Matt B. Davis, and have a great show for you today. Sarah, Tiana, and I had a little bit of a chat a few weeks ago. But first, I gotta say, this thing just happened, and I just gotta talk about it. I believe you know me to not be the preachy kind, to be the fake rah-rah kind of a guy. Something just happened in the elevator here at WeWork, and first of all, the fact that there are people in the elevator is a sign of the times. I came to this building for many, 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 many months starting last March, and you would never see someone in the elevator or in the bathroom. There were people in the building. I wasn't the only one, but it was so infrequently visited that the odds of getting in the elevator with anyone, just it just never happened. You just get on, and now it's like, oh, hold the door for that guy. But do they want to have the door held for them in COVID times? Anyhow, this is how my brain works. Guy gets on. Hey, how's it going? Good. How's it going with you? Well, it's Friday. And I was like, yeah, cool. You know, like it didn't, you know, people that sort of live for this, you know, Monday through Friday sucks and the weekend is only good. I just don't live that way. And I haven't for a while. So it was just weird. But I didn't say anything because whatever, who am I? And then he said, well, now I just got to get through till next Friday. And I was like, this cannot stand. I don't know this guy at all. I've seen him many times in this building, but this could not stand. So I just looked up from my phone and I said, you know, every day can be like Friday. And he kind of went, yeah? I said, yeah, man, every day can be like Friday. And I think he heard it, but I also think I might have confused him. And I also think that maybe, I don't know, maybe the next time I see him, we'll have a different chat. Maybe it had some effect on him. Maybe not. Maybe he thinks I'm a fucking Pollyannish whatever. But I do remember living like that. I do remember my life being so hectic of things I didn't want to do, including the weekends. Like if I had two jobs or something that I would wake up, that I would literally think like, okay, it's Tuesday. I got a crazy week. And then Saturday and Sunday, I have something. Okay, next Saturday. So 11 days from now or 13 days from now, I can sleep late. I do remember those days and they sucked. So just had to get it out there. That if you're living a life where you're only looking forward to 2 days, it doesn't have to be that way. And I don't know what you need to do. I don't know what you need to change. You know what's best for you. I'm just saying that it doesn't have to be that way. Because it was for me at one point and it isn't anymore. On today's program, Sarah Tiana. And as you're going to learn, we met all the way back in 1999 when I moved to Los Angeles. She was a young comedian making her way in Los Angeles like the rest of us. And then we're going to just take you on the journey of what the last 20-something years been like. And, you know, as the show title says, it's the Atlanta Podcast, where we talk to the famous, Atlanta famous, infamous, or anyone else I want to talk to. She is from here. And we never spent time together in Atlanta, but when we met back then and over the years she's come here, I've just, you know, she's a Southern gal. So I wanted to catch up with her. And she recently had a baby, and that's exciting. And just a lot's happened, obviously, in 20 years. So I thought I'd bring you my chat with her, Sarah Tiana, and all the wonderful things she's been up to the last 20 years. Away we go.
How old is your child?
He's 11 months. Yeah, he'll be a year old on the 25th of this month.
And what's his name?
Cage. Yeah. How old are yours?
13.
I was going to say, yeah.
11 and 7.
Oh, my God. You are in it. Is 13-year-old a boy or girl?
She's the best. She's 13. She's very she's very girly, self-contained, does her little schoolwork. The boys are fucking nuts. I have no idea whether yours will be or not, but you know, they mature slower. They're disgusting. You know, they don't clean up after themselves. They just eat and make a mess of the house, and COVID's been horrible. So what can I say?
I'm sorry. That does not sound fun. Yeah, no, I'm not looking forward to the boy aspect. I like that he's like super into the ball and like sports because we're such like sports people, but like that's about it.
You are representing the A for the audio listeners. She is wearing the old school A hat. Did you know Hank Aaron personally?
I met him once, but I didn't know him personally. No, I was just a huge fan from afar. I met him when I worked for the Braves in, what must have been 2000, because the All-Star game was in Atlanta in 2000, and they inducted the All-Millennium team that year. And so Hank Aaron and Ted Williams and everybody was there. So I got to just say hello, if that's really it, and just see them. I don't even know if they said hello back.
What about Ted Turner?
Never met Ted Turner, but yeah, still would love that. That's bucket list. I read his book.
What about Ludacris?
No, not a Sarah, not a what, interested.
What is the point of being, whatever level of celebrity you are, if you can't meet these people?
I mean, it just depends on who I want to meet too. If Ted Turner is always in Montana. He's not an LA guy. I don't know if you.
But I feel like with your reach, you could get these folks. That would be the first call I would make. I'd be like, dude, we got to get Ted Turner, Jimmy Carter, all the Georgia people, right?
Yeah. I mean, that would be great. I guess I never think to use my power and my influence. What very little there is for my own gain. I guess I'm just constantly I don't know. That's a good idea, though. The only thing that I've ever wanted to try to even make a flex with is throwing out the first pitch at a game.
Yeah, have you gotten that yet?
No. And I honestly haven't tried that hard. I've brought it up, but that's about it. I mean, I'm not really, and it's I'd also have to be in Atlanta, and it'd have to be I'd have to be there to throw it out. I'm not going to do it at Dodger Stadium when the Braves play here. That's no fun. I don't want to do that.
No. You want to do it in front of us. You want to do it for the hometown fans. All right. Well, is you got 81 chances next year. So just figure a weekend that you're playing a club and make it happen. Cause I bet that's somebody's gig, right? Somebody's gig at every MLB team is the first pitch. It's oh, Sally, the marketing gal handles that. And you just get in touch with her and listen, we've got an opening on the 27th and there you go.
Yeah, well, I'm going to try to ask Rich Eisen since my boyfriend's the co-host of the Rich Eisen show, and they helped Nick Boone do that for Seattle. And so I'm all right, I'm just going to make Rich Eisen make the call or put it out there on social media and on his show and then just strong arm them instead of just asking.
Yeah, I think you may as well use your biggest, if you're going to flex, you may as well use your biggest flex.
Yeah.
Rather than sending a little note, just be go with the Rich angle. So I love Rich. It seems let's back up. What town did you actually grow up in?
Okay.
What town did you actually
grow up in? I grew up in Calhoun, Georgia, which is between Atlanta and Chattanooga. It's it's right around All Lives Matter and really close to I'd Like to Speak with the Manager. That's pretty much where it is. It's right below the poverty line. So it's right there. Mm-hmm. It's I mean, it's named after John C. Calhoun. So that should tell you everything about my town. But I mean, it was a great place to grow up. It's Northwest Georgia, in the boonies. We moved there when I was 5 from California. So it was kind of a culture shock. And my parents didn't have an accent and then everybody called me a Yankee. And I was but California wasn't even in the war, and why am I calling it the war? I mean, it was just constant. And then I moved to LA and everyone's you're such a redneck. And I'm oh, I want to be a redneck my whole life.
Did you start stand up in Atlanta or did you start in LA?
No, I started in Los Angeles, because I moved to Los Angeles. I studied theater at Georgia State. I started at UGA, then I transferred to Georgia State. I studied film and theater. And I studied theater abroad in Paris my senior year. And I moved to LA to be an actor, couldn't catch a cold. And then, I just started doing stand-up on a dare 2 years later. And then it turned into a career. It found me. It wasn't something that I ever thought I could do. I had seen Mitch Hedberg at the Punchline in Atlanta when I went to school at Georgia State because we had a show on Album 88 and we would interview all the comics that came through the Punchline. And so he was the first comic I ever saw live. And people were like, oh, is that when you decided to do stand-up? And I'm like, you don't see Mitch Hedberg and go, oh, oh, I can do that. You know, right. Like, I was just like, I have no idea how this works. And I just moved on. And then I started stand up just on a dare in LA. And I guess it was just something that kind of found me, you know. Chappelle always says that starting stand up in LA is like learning to dribble in the NBA. So it's like, you really are around so many of the best comedians in the world. So you don't pick up as many bad habits, I think.
Okay. I had not thought of it that way. What year was that?
That would have been 2003.
So I met you, then I met you at the, like, literally very beginning then, like early, mm-hmm. early,
oh, yeah.
early open mics.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Like, we all knew each other at the very start. We, like, cause when did you start?
Well, I started in Boston in 96. I moved to LA in 99.
All right. Right. Okay. So you were already doing it when I started, and you were running rooms though.
Right. Well, it's right. interesting. It's interesting because, Sarah, like, everything I did in Boston to get, like, you know, to move my way up from, like, you know, open micer to middle was like, I worked really hard. I, like, did whatever. I was like, I hustled. I moved to LA with a fucking chip on my shoulder after doing it a mere, like, I'd been doing it 3 years. And it was like to go from like being able to make, like, you know, $50 in New Hampshire to, like, then you go to LA and you're like, have to do a coffee shop. And I, like, thought I was better than that, which is, like, the stupid, like, it was like, I forgot everything I learned because, you know, going on in life and learning, it's the same in all businesses. You fucking bust your ass and you, like, learn how to work with people and you, you know what I mean? Instead of having some sort of attitude about it. And that's what successful people do. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was the guy, like, you know, Maron always talked about in, like, early podcasts, how he was just the guy sitting around going, like, what is that guy of a fucking TV show? That was me instead of actually working on my craft.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I can imagine how hard that must be. But I guess because I started in Los Angeles, I knew how hard it was, I guess, because I wasn't good where I came from or anything. You know what I mean? So, like, I think, like, people get good where they come from and they move to LA and they expect that praise to come with them. And then you're basically starting over. You know, what you're ahead of is the writing. You're ahead in writing.
Unless unless you're really lazy at writing and not doing what you should be doing, which is wake up every day and writing. And so I thought you started a little before that. So, I had that, I had the room in the pool hall and, mm-hmm. And I think, did you do Stacy? So I started way before my wife, but she had a room at the Comedy Store and you were doing her stuff too, right?
Yeah, we helped Jerome Cleary run Belly Room on Friday nights. Yes. And yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah. So me and Stacey would help run that room so that we could get stage time. I mean, that's what you did. Like, once you kind of graduated out of Bringers, you had to run a room. And then that's what you traded for stage time wherever you were. So it's like, I'll get you in my room if you can get me in yours. And yeah, I mean, so that's what we did. And I mean, I played the music and, you know, set up all the candles and blew them all out at the end of the night, you know, cleaned it up. And it's just so crazy too, like, to see where the Comedy Store was back then and to see where it is now. It's just a night and day difference. It's so crazy how popular the Comedy Store became before the pandemic.
Right. Well, I mean, I know it was huge right back in the day, and then it was sort of like past its prime, I guess, but it's having some sort of resurgence.
It had a huge resurgence, when Chappelle came back from Africa, and it was just like the podcast movement created fans in Rogan and Maron. And then Louis C.K. started doing shows. Louis C.K. was really big and he would like, and all these people would always do shows at the Comedy Store because the main room sat the most people, more people than any club. It sat 450. But also we don't have cameras and cameras aren't allowed. And the cameras situation is very strict. Like the Improv, the Laugh Factory have cameras mounted. And they would record sets and put them online. And so many comics didn't want, especially like Chappelle, like just wanted to have this anonymity and like work on their craft without people recording it. And the Comedy Store is always really strict about that. And I think it was just like this perfect storm. And, you know, when we were at the Comedy Store, like if there were 60 people in the main room, you were like, we're going to get paid, you know? And like now they would turn that room over twice a night. You know what I mean? There would be at least 3,000 people that came to the Comedy Store every night. But by the time they turned over each room twice, it was just insane.
Cause that's like what they did in the '80s, bro.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, comedy, I think in general had this huge resurgence and then the Comedy Store was just like this perfect place that just happened to be like behind the times with cameras. So it kind of like created this atmosphere that was conducive for really famous stand-up comics.
So who were you? So at that time, early thousands, who were you watching that was getting on at the store or the improv that you were like, okay, that's who I love how they are doing their thing. Like, who did you want to be?
That's really tough. I mean, I guess Brody was always somebody that I liked to watch. It wasn't me like wanting to be like them, you know. I don't feel like I really had a lot of people that I was like, this is who I want to be. I think maybe Jeselnik. Jeselnik and I were really close. He wasn't a Comedy Store guy, but we were in a room together. And before he moved to New York, like, I really liked the way his brain worked and his comedy. So I would say that, like, I really looked up to him as a writer. He helped me a lot as a writer. I mean, we would meet at his place before we went to our room and just write, and then try out all the stuff that we wrote, you know, once a week. That was at Room 5 on La Brea, if you remember that place.
I do remember that place.
And, yeah. And well, so.
Wait a minute, was that the basement thing or was that something else?
It was up top. It was above a restaurant.
What was the weird basement thing?
The basement was in Santa Monica. Is that the one you're thinking of? Like, that was the Comedy Underground.
Because I remember, right? I think Comedy so, because I remember that room and I remember, you know, people often like to say like, oh, well, I knew this person, blah, blah, blah. Jeselnik, you absolutely knew something was going on. Like, this guy has something. Like, nobody is doing what he's doing. And
right.
And I think now there's even been kind of like way too much of it. Like this like dark mm-hmm. sort of like trying to be that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And back then he was the only one doing it in that style, in that way that's uniquely his. And mm-hmm. I remember him saying like, yeah, I work in the accounting office, but what did he do for, he like worked on, oh, sh- he was like worked in,
oh, production. He worked in accounting on Jeopardy. And then he worked at the Arclight too.
Yeah. But I just remember him saying like, yeah, I have a production job. That's my day job.
He worked on the Jeopardy production, I think. Like, he didn't like look for answers or anything, but he like helped in administration and Jeopardy. Yeah.
So,
I mean, we all had those day jobs, you know. I worked at the Four Seasons and forever. And Jeselnik, yeah, we all had like these crazy jobs.
And so,
I cut you off. Sorry.
No, you're fine. So, what path did you think yours was? Like, did you think your path was going to be, well, now that I'm in stand up, maybe I'll get more acting gigs or I want more writing gigs, or what did you think your path was going to be?
You know, when I first started stand up, I thought that you had to get a sitcom before you became a stand-up. And so like, I just had no clue basically about that. So I think my initial goal with stand-up was to turn that into some sort of sitcom and TV role.
But that's because I knew that I was, but that's all there was for us. That's
that, that is. Yeah.
Right.
And then I realized you had to start writing your own if you were going to do that. And at the time I had started a sketch comedy company. So because I couldn't afford Groundlings and UCB was not in LA yet. So I started my own company with seven other people, and it was called the Straight Jacket Society. And that's where I kind of learned to write sketches. And that's where I met a ton of other actors like Jillian Bell, you know, who's in a lot of movies, Lenny Jacobson, who's always on TV now, like all, you know, Camilla Cleese, who's John Cleese's daughter. And then John Cleese like came in and like helped us with our sketches, which is like so insane. And, you know, like it's like I just met all these great people. And I think what ended up happening in a process that this is not the path that I thought, like I became more of a writer and I just appreciated the craft of writing. I enjoyed writing for other people, not myself. And my career kind of turned into the roast and then just writing in general. And the roast was just like writing for the roast came really organically. Cause like I was running a room at the Unknown Theater, which was this old theater in Hollywood that was basically an old warehouse. And it was $5 to get in and you got free Bud and Bud Light all night. So comics had to pay the $5 and they would just come and hang out. And like, we would all support each other and watch. And Jeff Ross would always come and practice his roast jokes. And I was like, man, I really like these kinds of jokes, you know? And then I just saw him at a party one night, just happened to see him at a party And I was like, what's the next roast you're doing? And he told me, and I said, what's your email? And he gave it to me. And I just sent him jokes every day, all day, every day, all day, until he just could. For Jeff Ross. Oh, for the roast? That particular roast was Quentin Tarantino. It was like a charity event. And then the very next one was Charlie Sheen. And so he just finally like invited me over to his house and he was like, all right, come write with me. And then he's like, I can't pay you. And I was like, you don't have to pay me. Just remember me for a gig. And I ended up getting the very first, I wrote the first joke he said on the Charlie Sheen roast. And I wrote three or four more in that show for him. And then the very next thing that happened was he got his own show on Comedy Central called The Burn. And then he hired me to be a writer. And then boom, I'm in the WGA and here we go.
That's so great. That's so, no, it is. It's like,
yeah,
it's, but I think it's a good lesson in the, what we just talked about, like nose to the grindstone, like comedy and music, all these artistic endeavors are no different than any other business in that if you want to look at it like the fucking tortured, starving artist and not, or you can like get to work and you got to work.
Got to work right every day. Don't ignore me, you know, and like I knew my jokes were funny and good. And every time I wrote one, they got better. I mean, that's also how I got into the entire country music scene. Like I'm very into like close with a lot of country music artists in Nashville, because when I was waiting tables at the Four Seasons, I was like, I've been doing comedy maybe 2-3 years. And John Rich from Big and Rich came in and he heard my accent. And he's like, where are you from? I was like, I'm from Georgia. He's like, are you an actress? I was like, no, I'm a comedian. He's like, oh, I love comedy. I was like, I know, you ordered a Chardonnay. And then from there, like all of a sudden, he's like, can you write jokes about country music artists? And I was like, hell yeah. And I had never written a joke about country music. So I sent him a joke every single day for a year, just so he wouldn't forget about me. And then he started flying me out to Nashville to perform at his house, because he has this big 250 seat bar in his house. He always says he has a house in his bar, but he has this huge 250 seat bar in his house. And he hosts huge parties there. And from there, I just basically I was roasting before I realized I was roasting. I was just coming in to make fun of these people. It was like Merle Haggard's like dirty joke night. And then like, anyway, I started making fun of all these artists. I became friends with them. And then cut to, you know, 10 years later, I'm opening for Brad Paisley at the Hollywood Bowl. I mean, it all kind of comes in the same. But that just stemmed from me writing jokes every single day, sending it to him so that he wouldn't forget about me the same way I did with Jeff.
I think I'm getting really soft in my older age, but you almost made me cry when you said that. I mean, seriously, like when you're waiting to go on at the Hollywood Bowl, mm-hmm. do you take moments like that? Like look up and be like, thank you, God and baby Jesus. Like this is bigger than my dreams ever could have been.
I'm getting chills thinking about it right now. Cause like people are like, oh, is that on your bucket list? I'm like, never in a million years would I have even considered to put that on my bucket list. I was only the fourth comedian to ever perform there. So like the ones before me were Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy, wow. And Eddie Izzard. So I was the fourth. And then John Reap went up after me. He's the fifth. So technically he was the closer, but he's still the fifth. But, you know, no, of course. I mean, it was just like this moment where I was like, you know what? This probably isn't even going to go well, but I'm just going to have a good time and soak it all in because this is a moment I'm never going to forget for the rest of my life. And then I went out there with the mission of like, okay, I'm just going to tell jokes to the front because I know the people in the back aren't listening and everyone's getting beers and stuff. And I said, you know, my dad's a really tough guy. He fought in the Vietnam War. And the joke is mostly in bars with his friends because he dodged the draft. He didn't go. But anyway, I said, my dad's a really tough guy. He fought during the Vietnam War. And the whole place erupted in applause. And I was like, like, what if they're going to hate me when I say it? And then I go, mostly in bars with his friends. And everyone just laughed. And it just like settled everything down and I was like, I got this. And then I just went from there and like, I only did like 7 minutes, but it was great. It was amazing. And Brad was like, Brad's the one that set it all up and it was really fun. And we had a great time and, you know, and then I went on to open for Aretha Franklin at the Santa Barbara Bowl because they wanted a comic familiar with performing in outdoor amphitheaters. and we were at the same agency, and I was like, okay. And then that was like a completely different experience, and it was just me and her on the bill. It was just Sarah, Tiana, Aretha.
But listen,
it did not go well.
But listen, I love it. I love it. It's like they say about the Super Bowl, right? You got all the nerves, then you go out there, you get hit once, and it's just another game, right? So
it's
you got that big laugh, and it was like, all right, here we go. This is like another gig, right?
Yeah. And then for like Aretha Franklin, I didn't get a lot of laughs, but I got a bit out of it, which I think is actually more valuable.
Right. The comics would tell you, like, absolutely. Like, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Like, what's like, yeah. Like, that'll be the best thing about having your kid, right? Is like the endless amounts of material you get from marriage and kids is like, it's like every day something really ridiculous or stupid or thing that makes you angry happens.
Yep. Every day. Yeah, I feel like I haven't written enough about it, but I will.
You have the rest of your life. So how did the Spade stuff? How did the Spade stuff come along?
So with Spade, I had known David for a while because he performed at the Comedy Store. When he started like really doing stand up again and starting to perform, he was at the Store, and then I did his like New Year's Eve show, and then I went to Montreal with him and did his gala. So we were kind of friends, you know. He actually was one of my judges on the very first roast battle that I did. That's initially how I met him. I made fun of him. And then he was like, who the fuck is this? You know, and he kind of hated me, but loved me at the same time. And then, and then he got his own show on Comedy Central, and the guy that booked the Comedy Store was booking the comics for his show. And they asked me to just come and do like a rehearsal show. And I said, okay. And I did great. And so then they started bringing me on as a panelist. And then I was working on the roast of, what was the last one? Alec Baldwin. And I found out I was pregnant, and I was like, oh my God. And I had like 6 months of road work coming up, like once a week, basically. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I can't be like pregnant traveling this much. Like, this is just a nightmare. And I got an email from the producers, and they were like, this is really random, but we're looking for a new writer on Lights Out. Are you at all interested? And I was like, oh my God, like the heavens just gave me this huge gift. And I just was like, this is the greatest thing that could be happening to me right now. So I ended up getting that job, and I wrote on that show. And then I had to tell them, I was like, listen, I just want you to know that I'm pregnant, and I'm going to have to be off work for a couple of months and 9 months. And they were the only ones that knew. I hadn't told anybody yet. And so they were like, oh, totally fine. We don't care. Like, so excited. I was like, they're like, could we use it on the show? I'm like, yeah, sure. Not thinking that they would use it as much as they did. And then, and then I ended up being on that show, writing on that show for, I guess, 8 months. And then, that show got canceled right after the pandemic because, you know, Viacom is Viacom, and they weren't prepared to do anything digitally or online. And then we were kind of writing Dave's monologue for his bunker throughout the quarantine, like just staying close, helping out whenever I could. And then, you know, over the summer, I was like, are you guys gonna like come back, bring a show back? Because I could really use the work. And they were like, funny thing. we think we just sold a show with Dave to Netflix. And I was like, cool, thinking I had a writing job. And then the producers called me, and they were like, so we were just wondering if you'd like to be the head writer. And I just started crying, but I pretended like I was fine. And I was like, because it's also so daunting. I was just, they're like, you know, we want you to be a co-executive producer and the head writer on the show. And I'm like, are they crazy? Like, I've been the head writer on a couple of small things, but nothing this ginormous, not a worldwide show for Netflix. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'm totally interested, thinking once it goes up the chain, nobody's going to hire me anyway. But it was nice. And then it just kept getting advanced to every level. And I'm like, I don't know if these people know what they're doing. And then I get in there and I actually start doing it. And I'm like, oh, this actually makes sense. Like, I'm very good. Like, I'm very organized. And I'm very keen on making sure like every detail and every box is checked. And it's actually the perfect fit for me. I'm surprised I never thought of this job for myself. I think I just think of myself as like, I write dick jokes, even though I can't remember the last time I wrote a dick joke. My jokes are much more clean. But, you know, Spade and I are always on the same page because we're both really sarcastic. We're both clean. We don't really talk about politics. We don't really talk about sex or anything like that. So it makes so much sense, like, for us to be partners in this endeavor because our comedy is very similar, even though his is way funnier, but we think alike.
Well, it's, you know, so Spade, if you're old as me, you know, Spade was this smarmy guy from SNL before being a smarmy guy was a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And then he disappeared for a long time. You're like, you know what I mean? And he's, and as he's come back, you know, he's been like always happy to be self-deprecating. And that's what's like lovable about him is that he connects in that way, in that like he's like that fine line of like, I am famous, but I can talk shit about my own thing. So I happened to watch the bit, I don't know when it was put up, I'm guessing yesterday or 3 days ago, but like this thing about the stocks and Bitcoin and all that, right?
Oh, Bitcoin, yeah.
So does he come to you with, I have a kernel of this and let's write it together? Or like, how does that, because it was great. I watched it and, you know, I'm as hard as anyone. Like if you don't got me in the first 30 seconds, I'm swiping up. So like so is that sort of how it happens?
Yeah, sometimes he has the idea more fleshed out. Sometimes he's like, all right, this, everybody's talking about this, like we need to do something about it. And then we all kind of like verge, me and the other four writers just kind of like create it. And this particular one, one of our writers has been investing in Bitcoin since he was like 17. And so he knows a ton more about it. And so he almost wrote basically the whole thing. So him and Spade wrote it together. So I didn't really have very much to do with it except to like delete ones that I didn't think would work and then put them in order, put them in a cohesive way that I thought Spade would kill it. That's really all I did for that. I didn't do as much with that one as I normally do.
Right. So when you got this new gig, did you talk to him and be like, as soon as the first show went away, were you just immediately like, is David's team just immediately out pitching this to somebody else? Because now you can do that. Once upon a time, that would not happen. Like if you got fired from CBS or whatever, we weren't going to see you for a while. Now it's like, great, I'll take my shit to this platform. So is that just like what he was working on while, you know?
Yeah, I mean, unbeknownst to me, I wasn't out there pitching it. You know, I was just at home breastfeeding. So I wasn't really sure what was even happening. But yeah, they basically, the producers of Lights Out and David got together kind of, you know, took out the things that weren't working, added in things that they thought would work, and then kind of pitched it per platform. And then Netflix actually came to Dave and was like, we want to do, and they kind of worked it all out, I think, you know. But it, you know, it's so smart for their service because the After Party is basically a comedy talk show about the show that you just watched. So instead of like Talking Dead, which would do every episode, we're waiting till you're done with all the episodes. And then we come in and we go, here's the whole cast together. We're going to ask them all these questions that you're probably dying to know now that you finished the series, with lots of comedy and sketches and jokes everywhere, a game. And then we have Fortune, Feimster, and Len Hughes, who are two other comics who kind of add into the rapport of the conversation. So it's very fun. It's very cool. It continues to morph and change, but the only consistent thing is that it's very funny.
Well, and they seem to be giving you the freedom to like do it. Like, obviously there are some cool creative people at Netflix that are like, yeah, we trust you to make these choices.
Yeah, they actually, all of their notes have been incredible. They've been incredibly helpful. They've all produced lots of TV before. This isn't like their first endeavor. But our show is kind of the first of its kind on Netflix that's not political. That's, you know, David's specialty. And they have given us a lot of leeway. Ted Sarandos, who is in charge of Netflix, is a big fan, and he's helped us out a lot as well. So, you know, now we know if we die, it's all our fault. Oops. It's all our fault. It's not it's not their fault, because they gave us every reason possible to succeed.
So doing it the way you're doing it, and it's non-traditional, like how do you, like what's a season for you guys, or what's like a number of episodes? Like how are you going to structure the year?
You know, it's been a little different. Like we're not really sure what the season is. Like we're slated to do 18. That could change. It could go up. It could go down. But basically, we just try to grab on to any show that A, we know is coming out, or a show that, oh my gosh, all of a sudden it's doing well. We got to get on. Well, we got to do an after show for this. Like, so we got to do an after party on Bling Empire, because Bling Empire is huge, you know? And so sometimes you have breakout hits, and then sometimes you know a show is going to be huge or a movie is going to be huge. So we can pre-plan for that.
So then how much of your life becomes, I have to watch these programs?
My whole life is watching programs. Yeah, my whole life is like binging an entire season of something. And they are very cool because they give me access to the shows before they come out. So, because I also have to do the pre-interviews with the cast. So I have to call everybody and, you know, oh, poor me. Just have to call Billy Zabka and like talk to him about Cobra Kai. Oh, my job sucks. But like, it's been great. You know, it's like I've seen it, so I can ask them tons of questions. And we have the luxury of like having that show on our service. We can talk to them about spoilers because we're assuming people already watched the show.
Right. And you so get first it's access. Kind of fun. And you get first access. Yeah. Like they're going to give you. So it's funny enough. They have been filming that in front of my house. Like I live in the West End. And there's this little park in front of our house, and there's been a bunch of scenes there. Like,
no way.
I think episode 1 or 3, when he's passing out flyers to like join his dojo, and they're like, nice headband. That's like where my kids play basketball every day. And then there's a couple of other scenes. Anyway, it's pretty
cool.
That's
so cool.
Yeah.
Because they're filming Stranger Things in Atlanta too, right? Or in North. They're near my old house in near Rome.
Right. But like when they did the arcade, that was like in. Not Powder Springs, but Douglasville. And yeah, dude, they're filming. I mean, it's funny. We moved when we first had Emma in 2007, and like literally there were like C-stands in the parking lot next to our house. Like it was like, when did Atlanta become this thing? And now it's – I have to ask you, by the way, are you going to church after this? You keep fussing with your little collar there.
Oh, it's because it's a little tight. Like because I tried to like – that was what was taking me so long to log on was like buttoning this. No, I'm not going to church. No, that's nice of you to think though, but no, I'm going to the studio to film something, but that's, so I was like, maybe I should put on a nice sweater, but I'm still going to wear a hat because I'm still me.
What are you, what have you enjoyed the most in recent weeks?
From work?
Binging, yeah.
Oh, well, I really liked Lupin. Honestly, we're not going to have them on because they all speak French and we don't. Okay. But Lupin was an incredible show. I mean, I loved Bling Empire. I loved Bridgerton. There's a new show called Foe the Winx Saga that's pretty cool. It's basically Harry Potter but with fairies. It's Harry Potter. I don't know, like this, I gotta watch The Night Stalker. I heard that's really good. So yeah, I'm pretty much solo Netflix all the time because I work there, but their shows are pretty good.
Were you watching The Crown before?
Oh yeah,
before you got
I was watching it before I got the gig, and then I had to binge the new season because we had Emma and Josh on from that show for our end of the year special, who play Princess Anne and Prince Charles. We had them on at the end, and I watched Emily in Paris, Queen's Gambit, the whole thing.
Do you guys get the Queen's Gambit people?
We had Anya Taylor-Joy, the girl, yeah, for our end of the year review show. So normally we have people before anyone has seen them. Right. So like we filmed Bling Empire, I think before the show came out.
Right.
So I had to, you know, pre-watch that. And then the writers get access to. So we come up with field piece ideas and sketches and stuff. So our whole show is based on that one show. Our show is based on their show.
Got it. When things come back to normal, do you want to go back out on the road?
That is a tough question, you know, because I really like doing stand-up, but I love writing and I love being home. So it's kind of just like this constant push and pull, you know. I really like going out with other people. Like I love just I was opening for Tosh for the last 2 years, and that's like the most fun way to perform, you know. It was like, you know, you just fly with him for a couple nights somewhere and then fly right back home, and you only have to do 15 minutes and you have so much fun, and he's great to hang out with. Our kids have the same birthday. Like, you know, like that kind of environment is much more fun for me than just going out on the road by myself and doing an hour in front of 40 people who half of them love me and the other half have no idea who I am, you know? Like, yeah, just killing in the abyss is always difficult.
Yeah, I would think that getting a great producing, writing, head writer gig would be like, I'm never going in the road again. Like, that's to me, that would be the no-brainer. Unless it was like you said, unless they're flying you out, flying you right back. It's like, but yeah, doing a tour of your own seems like a lot of work you don't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the work that I mind. It's not the performing. It's the other 23 hours of the day that's hard, you know? It's like getting there, waiting to go up, waiting for an opener, waiting for, you know, like the host, having them ask you a million questions about comedy in LA, you know, selling my merch afterwards. Like, that's the part that's really hard, you know? If I could just go and perform and like not talk to anybody, that would be great. But I love talking to people. It's not that I don't enjoy talking to people. It is just really taxing and exhausting. And, you know, the money isn't great. So you're doing it for the passion of it. You're doing it because you like doing jokes. And I just wonder if the show that I'm giving them is worth their time, you know?
Oh, and I forgot to ask you how you hooked up with Rob.
Riggle?
Yes.
Oh, so, well, Riggle, so, when I wrote on the ESPYs, it was the year after Riggle hosted, and the head writer, became like one of my best friends, and the head writer is Riggle's writer. So whenever Riggle was doing Fox NFL Sunday, then I started writing for Fox NFL Sunday, and then Riggle and I just started being friends. And then when he did the Rob Lowe roast, I produced his segment, and so I produced him and Peyton Manning because I was the only one that knew anything about football in the writer's room out of 14 people, all dudes. So that tells you what writer's rooms in LA are like. But so I ended up producing his segment, and then that kind of bonded us a little bit more. We got really close, and then I wrote his pilot for TBS right after that, and then he just called me and was like, let's just do a podcast together. And I was like, okay. And then we did that for 2.5-3 years. And we still talk quite a bit. We're going to work together on some other things coming up, but we haven't really decided. We're still kind of like throwing things around what we want to do.
Speaking of Fox, do you write for Cousin Sal's bits?
Oh, I don't. I love Cousin Sal though. We've talked about trying to work together before, but we just haven't found the right thing. But no, I wish I wrote his bits. They're very good.
So I've known about Simmons because I lived in Boston, but I did not know that whole world until like 2 years ago. I found like the Bills, and that's all I listen to now is Bill Simmons and the Rewatchables and those guys. Mm-hmm. And I mean, every Monday when I get up, that's the first thing I put on is like, I only want to hear their takes on football. I don't care what fucking Stephen A has to say about football.
No.
I don't care what Colin Coward has to say. Like, I want to talk to people who are smart and funny, but not too smart and on my level. And
right.
I'm a huge fan of those guys.
So Bill and I, he watched, I think Kimmel actually judged one of my roast battles, the first season of Roast Battle when we were in Montreal. And then Simmons like DM'd me on Twitter and was like, you're my new favorite comic. Come to my studio. We're doing a podcast. And I was like, this is a joke. Because when Simmons got fired from ESPN, I went viral because I put like tape over my mouth and gave myself black eyes. And I was like, this is exactly what the NFL is doing by banning the truth. And so I have been a Simmons fan since he was there, you know, and the 30 for 30 franchise. So like when he is like sending me messages, and then I obviously am like a huge fan of The Ringer and everything that they do there. And when they did the Rewatchables on Top Gun, my favorite movie of all time, I was very proud of them. But yeah, so I agree with you. He is exactly that segment of sports is exactly who people should be obsessed with.
Yeah, because I find that there seems to be just so much garbage out there and just so much, you know what I mean? Like if Barstool is what I'm supposed to like, I'm like, no, like not even like I can respect what he's built, but I can't watch like any of their content.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of like reminds me of Dane Cook in a way, you know what I mean? Where you're just like, this is so funny and crazy, but what's the end game? You know what I mean? Like, how am I supposed to, I don't know anything about you personally. Whereas it's very easy. It becomes like forgettable. And then you kind of grow out of it, you know, the older you get. And especially as a woman, it's like, it's very difficult for me to like stay in that Barstool realm. I really like Big Cat. I really like some of the guys on there, but it has a point. But then I feel like with The Ringer, like there's more women, there's more like, it feels like a more comforting atmosphere. And yeah, like I don't have to be so smart. I can understand because I'm a fan, but I don't remember names and stuff like that. Like Chris, my boyfriend, is like insanely has this the most insane sports memory I've ever. I can't even fathom knowing that much or remembering a player's number from 1984 who played in Milwaukee. Like it's just the most obnoxious thing.
Well, it seems like that would be a great fit for you if you're ever looking for a gig over at The Ringer.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it. We talked about like we've had discussions about it. I did some I did some like one-off videos for them a long time ago, and Bill and I like went back and forth, and I actually when he had a show on HBO, I was I went out and did a field piece for him on his show, and that was episode 5 and it got canceled after episode 4. Right.
Every Wednesday.
Yeah, so it was just like it was like this really fun piece that I did with all these gamers at Staples Center, but it never aired. But I'm still friends with all those guys, and I'm still fans of all of them. And I'm sure we'll. It's a very small world, this writing business, and especially the sports world when it comes to comedy and writing. It's a very small world. We all know each other, so I'm sure we'll work together again.
Yeah, so I think you should pitch yourself for Rewatchables because he's always looking for good, fun guests. You know what I mean? You should totally pitch yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could just text him and like force my way in, but that's one more thing I'd have to watch. So
no, but it could be something you love. You know what I mean? Like you've already seen Top Gun 20
That's
times.
True.
Well, I remember I took a picture because I saw Rob at the Super Bowl in Miami, and I said like, "Oh, where are you? Were you pregnant then? Is that what's going on?"
Yeah, my boyfriend was there. I was like 9 months pregnant at the time. And
did you come here the year before? You must have, right? Atlanta?
I did not come to Atlanta. I went to Houston to see the Falcons in that Super Bowl. And that I was also doing garbage time that week. So I was actually there working. And then I stayed to watch the Super Bowl. And that wasn't a good one to watch. Didn't end well.
But you did come here for the Super Bowl?
No. No, I actually don't love going to the Super Bowl. I love watching it on TV. I'm a much bigger fan of watching it on TV. Like, I'll probably go to the one in LA because we have season tickets to the Rams, so we should be able to buy tickets. But other than that, it's like...
Well, no, I just meant for the media experience because, yeah, like, nobody wants to watch the game. Everyone would rather watch it at home and watch commercials with their friends, but just that you know, Radio Row experience of all the stuff there. Because, like, that was my first time going, it was here and I thought it'd be the only time I'd ever go. I'm like, well, it's here. I'll try to go. But then I realized it was kind of easier to get media passes than I thought. A big secret out there. So, and once you're in that room, you're kind of vetted. You know what I mean? People will talk to you, even if you don't have an appointment. I mean, some people are rude, some people are nice, but it's kind of an open forum to like, and it's a who's who. I mean, the LA one is going to be insane because it's in LA. So anyway, that's what I thought you would just go to those things.
It just depends, you know, it also depends on what I'm working on that week and what's going on. You know, Chris is usually my boyfriend, usually there Monday or Tuesday through Saturday. I'll come home on Saturday.
Right.
Cause they don't even want to stay for the game. It's just too hectic to try to come home. So most of them don't stay for the game and watch it at home. So, yeah, I don't know. Like we had a great time in Houston together, but yeah, I mean, I don't really want to go unless I'm working and I'm going to be making money to also be there. Like, I don't have to pay my way.
Right. I get it, dude. I get it.
Yeah, it's just the way it goes. So in LA, I won't have to pay my way. So I'll just be able to go to like parties and hang out and see my friends and people that I know without having to buy a plane ticket and fight through it all.
I hear you. So, well, listen, I'm glad we got to do this finally.
Yeah, this is so cool. It's so great. It's so weird to see. It's like a trip to see you when I like just remember. I remember when you and Stacey started dating. Like it's like all burned in my memory. It feels like no time has passed, even though it's probably been 15 years.
Yeah. I mean, luckily we've both aged decently well. I have some gray.
yeah, you look like the same.
Right. You know, I don't smoke or drink. That helps. Right. Like that helps you stay looking relatively young.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to say that
good for you.
And I want to say that I'm glad you got released from your Spotify contract. I'm sorry if you lost that job, but I reached out to Sarah and she's like, listen, I'm being paid very well to not be on anybody else's podcast. I can't come on your show. I'm like, I get it.
I'm really sorry. That was just like this weird thing that they did, but now, I'm not doing a podcast anymore. So no worries. It's all good. So I can do whatever I want, which is what I like.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for doing this. And it's good catching up, dude.
It's great catching up. Thank you for having me. Please give Stacey a big hug for me. Tell her I said hi.
I will. And tell people where and what they should watch for After Party.
It's called the Netflix After Party. It's on Netflix. You can search for After Party, or it should, if we are doing a show on your favorite show, it should just come up in your feed after you finish watching that show. So it's the Netflix After Party with David Spade. And then you can follow him on Netflix as a joke. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Sarah Tiana.
All righty. There it was, Sarah Tiana. You can keep up with her on Instagram, and she'll probably get back to touring when those things start to happen again. And thank you for spending time with the Atlanta Podcast. Please do me a favor. Tell a friend about this. Most things ask you to leave a comment or a review, which we're fine with. But the best thing you can do for this growing program is to tell friends. You know, I know you like podcasts. If you listen to this guy, Matt, he does some really good ones. And they're usually about people here in Atlanta. So there you go. Thanks for hanging in there with me. Love you. Miss you. Mean it. I have got to run.